You're listening to local and regional news on KMUN. I'm Ava Berardi.
And I'm Katie Frankowitz. Cannon Beach is looking at ways to shift human and elk interactions in and around the city amid ongoing concerns about dangerous and risky situations involving the large animals. In 2019, the Clatsop Plains Elk Collaborative was designated as an Oregon Solutions Project by then-Governor Kate Brown. Clatsop County Commissioners and the mayors of Seaside, Gearhart, and Warrenton signed a declaration of cooperation along with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife to explore a variety of methods to control herds in and around the Clatsop Plains area. Cannon Beach was not part of that process, but has been experiencing its own elk issues over the years. In April, city leaders heard impassioned testimony from people urging for more management, as well as those saying the elk need to be left alone. This week, city leaders listened to a marketing strategy that aims to educate visitors and residents alike. Beginning at the end of May, the city expects to see educational materials, stickers, and posters distributed to local businesses, and will also launch a paid ad campaign. City Councilor Gary Hayes says he doesn't expect the campaign to solve the problems of people who willfully make bad decisions around elk, but city councilors say they hope it will raise some awareness. The city council plans to discuss additional measures around the elk at a work session in June.
The Tillamook City Council voted unanimously at a recent meeting to raise the city's sewer rates by 35%. The increase will take effect on July 1st. Water rates will remain the same. The council also voted to seek a general obligation bond in next year's election to prevent the need for large future rate increases. More detailed information will be available once the city hires bond counsel and enters discussions with financial institutions about the specifics of a bond they can seek. For now, City Manager Sean Lewis says the additional revenue generated by the rate increase will be used on capital projects, including stabilizing the wastewater utility fund while the city goes through the bond process. Should the bond fail at the ballot box, Lewis said he would return to the council to discuss other possibilities to meet the city's financial needs. This story comes to us through a news partnership with the Tillamook Headlight Herald, online at TillamookHeadlightHerald.com. After two landslides damaged the highway during the December 2025 storms, US 101 south of Neskowin has fully reopened. Traffic is moving normally through this section of US 101. OR 229 remains closed. The Oregon Department of Transportation is working on plans to build a temporary access road while also designing a long-term project to permanently rebuild the road.
After months of turmoil, the superintendent of the Bandon School District on Oregon's southern coast has resigned. Jefferson Public Radio's Jane Vaughn reports.
Superintendent Shauna Schmier gave her 60 days' notice after 5 years working at the district. Her resignation letter says she's been presented with future opportunities, but she declined to give further details. This follows months of turbulence in the small coastal district, including a series of teacher resignations, allegations of administrative misconduct, and the superintendent saying she's faced slander and abuse. At a Monday meeting, the school board also accepted the resignations of another 9 employees and of 2 board members. Brianna Hutchins and Angela Cardis blamed the teachers' union and community members for what they called negativity, hostility, and toxicity in the district. A union representative says they were disappointed by the attacks, as union members advocate for accountability and transparency. Those 2 board seats are now vacant and will need to be filled. I'm Jane Vaughn reporting.
Environmental groups are seeking a temporary restraining order to protect an old-growth forest about 40 miles southwest of Eugene. KLCC's Zach Ziegler reports the groups claim to have evidence that trees were illegally cut down in that area.
Cascadia Wildland says its volunteers recently visited an area where harvesting is on hold due to a lawsuit, only to find that trees that are more than 170 years old had been cut down. Cascadia legal director Nick Cady accused one of the defendants, the Bureau of Land Management, of speaking out of both sides of its mouth.
On one hand, it's selling people this timber. On the other hand, it's promising the court that it won't be logged. And so I think a series of misrepresentations are just finally catching up with the agency.
BLM did not return a request for comment. The other defendant, the American Forest Resource Council, says it does not represent the company that holds the timber rights to the area where trees were allegedly cut. I'm Zach Ziegler reporting.
This is KMUN.
Portland General Electric will soon increase rates for large energy users like data centers. That's after Oregon utility regulators issued an order under the state's Power Act. The law creates a new category for these types of energy users to pay for their share of electricity use. 16 data centers will be impacted by this order. PGE's Ben Morris called it a step in the right direction.
We now have more tools to ensure that the customers who are driving growth are the ones paying for it while still supporting economic development in the region.
PGE has until June 3rd to determine how rates will change for all its customers. Oregon's pear growers had a bad 2025 season. As OPB's Alejandro Figueroa reports, they're hoping the federal government steps in to bring much-needed aid.
Oregon's pear industry was hit hard last year for a few reasons. One of them, there was a lot of fruit last summer. And that, coupled with the closure of the Del Monte cannery in Yakima, meant there were more fresh Bartlett pears on the market, lowering their price. On top of that, a lot of Anjou pears were infested with a pest that makes the fruit impossible to sell. The industry estimates it's looking at $40 to $45 million in losses. Leslie Tamara is a pear grower and chair of the Columbia Gorge Fruit Growers.
We are basically having to turn to lines of credit or leveraging our personal assets to try to keep us going until we may get some more money later this year.
Hood River County officials are now considering whether to declare an emergency, which could trigger federal aid. Alejandro Figueroa reporting.
When beavers build dams, they help create a habitat for other species. But when they build near humans, those dams aren't always appreciated. NWPB's Rachel Sun reports on how some humans are trying to strike a balance between their needs and the beavers.
A few miles south of Pullman, Washington, hobby farmer John Brown is showing me his property. We're stopped beside a stream lined by poplar trees.
And all these hybrid poplars that you see here were planted in the last 20 years or so. That, I think, may have been part of the reason that I attracted beavers.
For over a decade, Brown says, he fought the beavers. The animals might be cute, but they also have a propensity for damaging trees. They can also threaten existing buildings and landscaping near waterways. Brown points out one poplar tree that leans over a walking path because the beavers chewed through its roots. Then he points to rows of flowers nearby.
And this is a project. These are all daffodils, and they follow every fence line. And I have lost probably 1,000 of those to beavers. They flooded, and daffodils couldn't tolerate the water.
But, he says, about 4 years ago, his battle with the beavers changed.
I was tearing out 6 dams a day up and down the stream, and I accidentally fell into the stream in January. And I said, that's it. I'm not doing any more of this.
Brown is using a different approach. With the help of a local nonprofit, he installed something called a pond leveler. Those work by allowing water to quietly pass through a pipe that's been installed in the dam. Melissa McKelvey is an assistant regional habitat program manager for the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife. She says pond levelers
allows enough flow to pass through that dam that we're able to abate some of the ponding that's occurring that's putting people's structures at risk.
Pond levelers aren't 100% foolproof. Sometimes sediment-heavy water or especially industrious beaver families can necessitate additions or added maintenance. In Brown's case, staff at a local nonprofit are helping install another leveler soon because the pond has been rising again. Still, McKelvey says, those pond levelers are often a more practical long-term solution than simply removing the beavers and destroying the dams.
When you are trapping, you have good habitat. And so the habitat, there's going to be beavers that move in. You're probably going to have just other ones move in, like, you know, a year later, 6 months later.
Environmental groups say they're still working to get people on board and familiar with the idea. Brown says some of his neighbors think he's crazy, but the beavers aren't all bad. Brown's pasture stays green in the summer thanks to the added water. And there's a lot more wildlife. Near the pond, there's a constant thrum of calls from red-winged blackbirds, California quail, mallard ducks, ravens, kestrels, geese, and more. All in all, Brown says he's willing to put up with some hassle for the benefit those beavers create.
Just all the birds and things, they have a choice of the wheat fields or come in here with trees and water. I had three deer here yesterday. Yeah, it's really nice.
Reporting near Pullman, Washington, I'm Rachel Sun.
Seattle public health officials say three King County residents have been possibly exposed to the hantavirus strain that hit a cruise ship this month. Despite that, officials stress that the risk to the public is low. One King County resident was on the ship and is now being quarantined at a specialized facility run by the University of Nebraska. Two other county residents were potentially exposed when they boarded a plane and sat near another cruise passenger. Dr. Sandra Valenciano is with Public Health Seattle and King County.
The individuals are currently feeling well and they are undergoing symptom monitoring, which includes daily temperature checks and regular communication with our public health team. Even though they were identified as contacts, they are not considered contagious because they currently do not have symptoms.
Valenciano says the situation is very different from the COVID outbreak and says public health officials have a lot of information about hantavirus and how it spreads. She also says that public health has strong contact tracing procedures in place.
You're listening to News on KMUN. I'm Katie Frankowitz. The Iran war has stretched into its third month, and more than 50,000 U.S. troops remain in the Middle East. Meanwhile, military veterans at home are watching the situation with a mix of concern, skepticism, and caution. From Fairbanks, Alaska, Shelby Herbert reports for the American Homefront Project.
In 1979, Fairbanks Army veteran Daryl Frank packed his bags for a deployment to Iran that never came. He was part of the Division Ready Force at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. His unit was preparing to parachute into the Middle East during the Iran hostage crisis.
We had all our gear ready, and we got the call to go to the airport, and they took us into this area with barbed wire and armed guards walking around it so nobody would run away. And we were like, yeah, this is what we've been training for.
The orders got called off. The hostages eventually were released, but the crisis marked a new era of hostility between the U.S. and Iran's then-new theocratic government. Daryl Frank is now retired from the Army and is the president of the Alaska Native Veterans Association. As he sipped coffee at the River City Cafe in Fairbanks, he said today's service members are facing a much more advanced Iranian military.
All through the years, they've acquired these weapons and whatnot. They didn't have the missile technology back then, or guided missiles, or anything like that.
Frank says his thoughts lie with the service members deployed to the area. He hopes they come home safely, with their heads held high, and without what he calls a moral injury.
You go in there knowing that that's what you signed up for, but it's a hell of a lot better than staying here and fighting it on your homeland, which is eventually going to happen one of these days.
Alaska has the largest concentration of veterans in the country, and Alaska Natives have the highest rate of service among any demographic. But sometimes it's a complicated relationship with the United States government. Some Alaska Natives joined the military decades ago after growing up in boarding schools intended to forcibly assimilate them.
We as Alaska Native people are still dealing with that, still recovering from that.
Alaska Native Veterans Association member Hugh Walker served in the Navy in the 70s. He says getting separated from his family and culture as a kid informs his feelings about the Iran War and about President Trump.
I just think it's a racist war. Not only that, but, you know, with his immigration policy, mostly brown people. And that really affects me because I'm a product of the boarding home.
At a Fairbanks No Kings rally in March, veteran Scott Justison weaved through the crowd, dressed in his old army camouflage and a T-Rex mask, handing out copies of his zine, The American Regressive. He served from 2005 to 2012 and deployed to Iraq.
Well, I joined under the George W. Bush administration after we had already invaded Iraq. And I wanted to learn about the human side of the military. There's the tendency on one side to dehumanize the members of the military as though they're kind of beasts that want to go out and commit violence.
He opposes the war in Iran and knows it isn't popular with Americans, but he hopes people don't take it out on the troops.
Some of my friends are in there because they have family, they have debt. You're not going to just quit based on your values if you're entrenched in debt and stuff. And so they try to make the best of it in a day-to-day compromise, like we all do in one capacity or another.
Though President Trump has declared the Iran war over, thousands of U.S. troops who deployed to the region remain there. Justison says he fears the war in Iran could become another years-long Middle Eastern entanglement, just like the war he served in. Reporting in Fairbanks, I'm Shelley Herbert.
Local and regional news on KMUN is brought to you by our news partners and by the KMUN news team. For more local and regional news, go to kmun.org/news. American Democracy Minute is up next. You're listening to KMUN.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. In yet more redistricting news, the South Carolina Senate failed to reach a two-thirds vote to extend their session to redistrict the state's congressional map. Missouri Supreme Court upheld a new congressional map designed to gain another GOP seat by diluting black voting power in Kansas City. In an 87-27 vote May 7th, the South Carolina House approved an extension of the current session to redistrict, but May 12th, the state Senate failed to reach the two-thirds threshold needed. Five Republicans, including State Majority Leader Shane Massey, joined Democrats in stopping the effort. Massey was quoted by news outlet The State as telling his colleagues, "Crushing the minority opposition is not a demonstration of strength." The map endorsed by the White House would have likely unseated 17-term black congressman James Clyburn. The Missouri Supreme Court upheld a lower court's ruling that maps diluting black voting power in Kansas City did not violate the state's constitution and will allow the map to be used in the August primary regardless of a pending referendum to repeal it. The map splits the 5th Congressional District along Kansas City's Troost Avenue, dismantling a district held by 11-term black congressman Emmanuel Cleaver. We have links to local reporting and more on the erasure of black representation in Congress at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.